For those, just to let everyone know, we decided not to do a sixth class. This will be the last one, which will conclude. I will begin by just answering a few things people have emailed me, and then I'm going to go into the part I said maybe will be there'll be more discussion or disagreement with me on what I think what is no longer relevant in Rav Kook's ideas. And then, depending on how much time we have, because we weren't going to go on to Weimar today, I prepared some other stuff, tangential really to Rav Kook's ideology, but still interesting if we have time. People ask me about it. I have a few things I could say on his view of vegetarianism that a number of people seem to be interested in, and a few other things. And then I'll sum up, basically, for the modern Orthodox, looking at Rav Kook, what is it in him that the modern Orthodox really could use, and what not? So let us then begin. I want to begin with Hillel Bezdin's comment last week. You might remember that we are not going to get to Rabbi Weinberg because we decided not to do a sixth class, and we really can't give him a half hour. You need more. You need an hour for him. So we will we'll do him another time, I guess. Hillel Bezdin asked. We spoke about. Yeah, you'll have to read the. You haven't read the book then. We were speaking about Rav Kook's view of evolution and how in the world, evolution, you know, you're moving in the physical world to greater, moving up, I guess, progressive from cells into complete bodies and the minds. Everything's moving up. And Rav Kook made the analogy to that to the world, that as time goes on, we become more advanced intellectually. We have a more of an ethical sense. And Hillel pointed out, and this is... It wasn't clear yesterday, but now I know what he's talking about, that today, if you take an evolution course in any university, they will say that unlike Rav Kook, evolution is random, completely random. Whereas Rav Kook really was speaking about intelligent design, that everything moves from less simple to more complex, and just like in our lives. But as far as... I'll get to your question. It's a good question, Jonathan. But Rav Kook really is not speaking evolution today. For modern scientists, this is all random. So there's no notion that you can say we're actually moving to more complexity because it could become less complex tomorrow. We could all, we could go extinct. Whereas Rav Kook saw it as moving forward inexorably. I don't think you were here for last week. You weren't here, Jonathan. We spoke about Rav Kook's view. It really is a view of progressive revelation. But it's not only him. We spoke about Rav Henkin's notion that now the abolishment of the death penalty with the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash is because we're moving to a more ethical sense. So Rav Kook spoke about how ethics are becoming more refined. So he did, and that's where Tamar Ross gets her whole notion of progressive revelation. Of course, she just applies it to feminism, that now we're more in tune with women's issues. So the same thing that Rav Kook said about other areas, and we spoke about human rights last class, that we're more attuned to human rights. She says the same thing about feminism. It is progressive revelation. Obviously, Rav Kook never used those terms, but it is. When I said Henkin, I'm referring to Rabbi the great Eliyahu Henkin, who was considered the leading posek in America in the 1950s. Really, till Ramosha Feinstein came on the scene in the 60s, Rabbi Henkin was the leading posek in the United States, and he remained together with Ramosha Feinstein, the leading poskim. His grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, is a leading posek now for the modern Orthodox, and the son of Rabbi Henkin is Louis Henkin, a world-renowned scholar of law. He has four volumes of Tshuvot, B'nei Vanim, Yehuda Herzl Henkin, as well as a volume or two in English. A very interesting figure. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein asks, is there an ethic outside of Halakha? And he basically concludes there is, although it depends how you define ethic. Once you define the terms, but he brings plenty of examples. I mean, it's pretty obvious there's an ethic outside the Halakha. The whole notion of the Noahide laws, that is, you mentioned homosexuality, the idea that this is something that the man is supposed to be able to come to on their own, although Chaim Rappaport now is trying to argue just the opposite, that unlike everyone seems to have argued for all these years, homosexuality is not one of these laws. But the assumption pretty much has always been that the Noahide laws, for example, are outside of strict halakha. They're something you come to naturally. And if you can come to something through natural law, there could be a natural ethic as well. And Rav Kook clearly believed that there was a natural ethic and there's a notion of conscience. Very few people have this conception that there's no notion of conscience. Everything is halachic-centered. Well, as Rav Kook, we spoke about this also, it's not that Rav Kook says that in response to changes, you actively change halacha. What he says is that halacha will change on its own through the people doing it, not listening to the rabbis, and then ex post facto, the rabbis will find a justification for it. That's the progressive revelation. And this differs very much, I said last class, from the contemporary feminists who are conscious of what they're doing. And as Yitz Greenberg told them, make facts on the ground. Rav Kook is not talking about that. But he is talking about pious communities developing things that are perhaps not exactly in accordance with halacha, that then has to be justified by the posik ex post facto. That is his, and because of the notion of Kol Hamon Kol Shaddai, that the Jews, if they're not prophets, their children are prophets, that's how divine providence works. Well, no, you can't say, I don't know of any traditional figures that say you can be more ethical than the Torah. What they say is that the Torah is only giving you the floor, not the ceiling. So, for example, and this is what Rabbi Weinberg thought also, so, for example, you'll have laws about slavery because the Torah is dealing with the period, that era. Rabbi, the article that is mentions Rabbi Henke's position is by Rabbi Rabinovich in the Eidah Journal, in which he develops at great length the idea that much of what we know as halakha is only floor, not ceiling, and that our job is the halakha is the basic thing, and we have to then go beyond that. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. When I was in Gateshead, when I was in England, I visited Gateshead, and I was in the Sfarim store, and I asked the guy who runs the store, how much is this sefer? And he told me, he gave me a price, and he said, but it's, let's say, he said $20, but if you're a yeshiva bachur, it's $15. So later in the day, I was speaking to the rabbi of Gateshead, Rabbi Rakloff. He was a student of Rabbi Weinberg, and I asked him, would it have been permissible for me to have one of the yeshiva bachurim buy the sefer for $15, and then I buy it for him and save the $5? And Rabbi Rakloff, who was a leading postdoc in England, he said it would be 100% mutter according to Jewish law. It's a kinyan, an acquisition's made, but it wouldn't be ethical. And that's really the Ramban's point, that you can get drunk every day if you want, as long as it's kosher wine. There's nothing halakhically wrong with it, but the Ramban develops the idea that the notion of this supererogatory, that we are called upon to move beyond the halakha, kadoshim tiyu, the Torah says, be holy, and the Ramban explains it to mean that every individual, you can't have straight rules because everyone's different, every individual is called upon to move beyond basic halakha, to try to move beyond, because he coined the phrase, you could be a naval b'yishut ha-Torah, you could be a scoundrel with the Torah's permission. So halakha, it's not that we're more ethical than the Torah, because the Torah doesn't say, you have to do this, and we're going against it. We're being more ethical than the Torah's basic rule. That is, the Torah has a basic rule. Yeah, someone has a comment?
Yeah, going back to last week's class, according to Rav Amital, then, eating the fellow human being after the crash, that in a way would be, not sure to say, beyond the Torah, or at least it's in conflict with the Torah's.
That is an example. Yeah, I was speaking about Rav Kook and the others. That would be in conflict with halacha in the micro, but Rav Amital's position is that there's a macro element, tzelem Elokim, which is able to override the micro. It all depends. When you look at Jewish law, do you look at the macro, and do you take everything into consideration, or do you look at the individual? And, there's matters that sometimes you look at the macro, not the micro. And that's where Rav Amital was looking at. Are you going to say we don't encourage non-religious Jews to get married to other Jews because there's all sorts of Isurim? Instead, we encourage them to get married to Jews. Rabbi Kamenetsky said that's idiotic, even though maybe the issur of being married to a non-Jew is less, technically, than two Jews who are not following various halachot, ritual purity halachot. He said, but that's looking at it, the micro. And there's also a macro here, in that we have a larger concern. So I think Rav Amital's point was there are larger concerns that are also part of Torah, although they're not part of halacha per se. They're overarching. No different than people like following in Rav Kook's school of thought said that the Rambam doesn't include living in the land of Israel as a mitzvah, as a commandment, but it's an overarching commandment. That is, it suffuses all aspects of Judaism, they believe. So Rav Amital would say that the notion of in God's image has to suffuse every halakha. It's greater than particular halakhot. So that's not saying you're more ethical than a halakha, would be what the conservative movement does. Let's say there's something called conscience. That is, that you have a woman, let's say, if a man is a Kohen and he wants to marry a divorcee, according to the conservatives, you try to find out if there's a heter, maybe he's not really a Kohen, but at the end of the day, if you can't, you don't say, well, it's a hard law, you know, you simply say, now we go back on conscience, and therefore we permit the marriage, and that's really what this gay thing's all about. You're falling back on conscience, that the Orthodox don't do. It's very different. They're not saying you can fall, conscience can trump the halakha. What they're saying is that there's other elements in the halakha. Now, I grant you, the conservatives will say there's other elements in the halakha also. Conscience is part of the Torah as well. So it's a slippery slope, Rav Amital's position. Next thing you know, you're at Judith Hauptman's position. If you read her essay in the Jewish Week, she said, Tzelem Elohim is the most important aspect of the Torah, therefore we need to apply this to the homosexual issue. That's why it's a hard position. You're going on the slippery slope. But as I said last week about Rav Kook, and Chesterton said it as well, it's better to be, you know, in the middle, shaking back and forth, than being on one side or the other. I mean, that's what being religious is all about. It's not about just having it easy. It's about finding these middle grounds and going with the flow. That's what makes it, that's what we're called to do. But it does raise interesting questions, and the lines are not always clearly drawn.
It's still nice to know that Rav Amital is still within the Orthodox camp, and his view is still legitimate as an Orthodox view.
You know, he's never actually written this. It's famous in the yeshiva, and Alan Brill wrote about it in the Last Day Jot journal. He's never actually written and justified it, but it's a well-known machloket. And if you read his book, by the way, his recent book that came out in both Hebrew and English translation, you do get a number of... He doesn't mention that in particular, I don't think, but he mentions other examples of where the ethics have to suffuse the halakha as a whole. But I don't know if this is anything new. Real post-scheme take these things into consideration. They don't always necessarily publicize it, but they take it into consideration. And yes, if you read Rav Amital's book, it is very interesting. He is very much on the left, not just politically, but even halachically. He's very much on the left in many of his ideas, and that's well known. Okay, I want to now sum up what I see as the major ideas of Rav Kook. If we have time at the end, I want to go through, as I said, some other interesting things. I read over Shabbat. I finished Shemona Kvatzim, and there are some amazing things in here, things that never before appeared in Rav Kook's writings. They refused to allow them because they were too controversial. So maybe at the end I'll read you some of them. One of them, they're just amazing stuff. But I want to make sure that we have time to at least do the main point of what I want to speak about, because it is very relevant, and especially in the last year has become even more relevant. And that is what I believe is no longer relevant in Rav Kook's thought, and which is central to his thought, and I'm giving my opinion now. Up to now, pretty much, I've been giving you the standard views of what Rav Kook was all about. I haven't given you my opinion, really, except when it was clearly my opinion. But now, I'm going to give you what I think up front. As we discussed, Rav Kook saw a great deal of good in the non-religious Zionists, yet the way he defined matters was very different than at which the secular Zionists defined it. What did the secular Zionists say? They said they were coming to create a new country, a new land, based on the Jewish ethnicity, in which religion will have no part, because religion is about being weak, it's about spirituality. They wanted to be real people in this world. They said that they were opposed to traditional Judaism, they were even opposed to God. And what did Rav Kook say? That no, they were really serving God and serving Torah without knowing it. Now, I mentioned two classes ago, the conference I went to when I was in Israel in 1985, that was my year in Israel, that was the 50th anniversary of Rav Kook's death in 1985, and there was all sorts of events. I will tell you, by the way, that last year was the 70th anniversary, and under normal circumstances, there would have been all sorts of conferences, but because of the disengagement, all these followers were so busy going down to Gaza and creating a political debate, opposition, that really his 70th Yahrzeit passed without anyone paying any attention to it. It's Hey Elul. Not Hey Elul. Yeah, I think it's Hey Elul or three Elul. It's the third of Elul is his Yahrzeit. So at this conference that I said it was confusing because the Americans, everyone would speak about the Rav and Harav, and it depends. You weren't always sure if it's Rav Soloveitchik or it's Rav Kook. Well, Rav Lichtenstein gave a presentation at that event also. It took about 50 years since the passing of Rav Kook, and he said that from his standpoint, he's not a great follower of Rav Kook's ideas. He said that the way he saw it, Rav Kook was guilty of, as he called it, Ganevat Da'at, Ganeva Stas. What is Ganeva Stas usually? It literally means stealing someone's knowledge. So obviously we know what Ganeva is. You steal someone's money or someone's car. Ganeva Stas is you cheat on a test or you invite someone over to your house to have Shabbos dinner and you know he's going to be away that Shabbos, but you're just doing it to get on his good side. It's called Ganeva Stas. What Rav Lichtenstein meant was he said that Rav Kook was telling, these people were saying that we're anti-religious, we hate religion, we want nothing to do, and Rav Kook said, well, that's what you think you say, but really deep down inside you really are for religion, you just don't know it. And Rav Lichtenstein said, that's Ganeva Stas. He's taking their viewpoint, their das, and stealing it and saying you really don't believe what you say you believe. And he said it's very problematic. According to Rav Kook, a Jew cannot cut themselves off from Judaism. It's like saying that we cannot cut ourselves off from being human. But I think Rav Lichtenstein was correct. And I think 20 years later, we can even say more so. From our vantage point, we're now three generations after Rav Kook's death. I think that there are two basic problems with Rav Kook's approach. And by the way, the approach is alive and well. I was listening today. I download things on discs. I drive a lot to Scranton. I listen to them. The best Hebrew website is yeshiva.org.il. It's the Yeshiva of Beit El, and they have lectures there and videos from all the religious Zionist rabbis. I was watching today Avram Shapiro on video, and I was with Shlomo Fisher, Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, and many other people, especially the super right-wing religious Zionists. I was listening to all their stuff against the disengagement, and there was a number of lectures there in which the question is, well, how, since everything seems to be going against us, how do we make sense of it? And basically they all had the same point, that it just appears to be against us, and they explain why not. Well, I think the problems with Rav Kook's approach is as follows. The first is it's incorrect. It's yeshiva.org.il, I believe. It's the Beit El Yeshiva. This is the city of Beit El. I'm sure many of you know it. Rav Aviner is the rabbi of that city. It's a Chardal city, religious Zionist, and there's a yeshiva there, a very big Chardal. Chardal is like religious Zionist, but not like Hezder, the followers of Rav Kook and his student, especially his son Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the settlers. And the interesting thing now is that there is a big feud between Rav Aviner. Rav Aviner told people not to protest the disengagement. And Rav Zalman Melamed, who's the Rosh Yeshiva there, was very much in favor of protesting it, and soldiers as well. So they pretty much put Rav Aviner into Cherem, and the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rav, who used to be the best of friends, no longer talk to one another, and Rav Aviner is not welcome in the Yeshiva. And this is the Yeshiva. If you want to hear Rabbi Aviner's stuff, it's also online, all of it, except they don't let you download it. You can get that on a Teret Kohanim. But I didn't know they were Mechutanim. Rav Aviner and Zalman Laman are Mechutanim? Well, that's good to know. I did not know that. If you're really interested in the politics, go to www.avinir.net, and you will see the Cherem against Rav Aviner. It's not so much a Cherem, it's a ruling by many Gedolim saying Rav Aviner is no longer allowed to pasuk in Shilas, and it's full of Lashon Hara about all the terrible things Rav Aviner has done, and he's one of the great leaders of the religious Zionist world. Okay, now, so what's the, yes, how sad, but what's new? The Haredim are killing each other in Ponevez and everything, so is it any different that now the religious Zionist rabbis are killing each other? What do I mean when I say Rav Kook was wrong? Rav Kook believed, as I said, that the secular Zionist activities were all part of an effort to revitalize Judaism, and religious observance would follow. Now, it's been 80 or 90 years since then, and not only has religious observance not come by the secular Jewish population, but matters have gotten much worse. The typical secular Israeli today, I mean, two generations ago, these people still grew up. They still knew about it. They knew Torah. Many of them grew up religious. The typical secular Israeli today knows zero about Judaism. He maybe learns a little Bible in school, but they know nothing. And this is obviously seen in how the Israeli secularists, when they leave Israel, they come to America, they have no Jewish affiliation whatsoever. They are Israelis. So, and now, especially, no one even knows how many non-Jews are in Israel with these Russians. So there's no sign of what Rav Kook thought would happen, that the secularists, once the state was established, they would return to Judaism. How long can you continue to maintain the fiction that when people hold an anti-religious position, an anti-religious ideology, and in many cases really want to destroy traditional religion, that they're really helping the religion, which is what Rav Kook thought? I think from our vantage point, it's obvious, at least in my opinion, that for all the good done by the Israeli secular Zionists, look, they created the state of Israel, their strong opposition to religion was simply that, without any positive flip side, and that you have to deal with it. And so that's one point where I think Rav Kook's ideology just hasn't stood the test of time. Secondly, all right, recognizing this, I'll say something else. It becomes much harder, I think, to see the state of Israel in these messianic terms, Reshit Smichat Gulatenu. We all say it in the prayer for the state of Israel every week, that the state of Israel is the beginning of the redemption. Rabbi Soloveitchik never said that. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik never said that, because their attitude was, how do you know this? And why are we involved in these messianic ideas? There's a state, that's a good thing. But, and this is quite apart from the fact that we can't, you know, who of us among us can know this? Who has Ruach HaKodesh to say this? But with the long-term prospects of the state looking ever more bleak Jewishly, that is, I don't think there's any doubt that there's going to be a separation of religion and state in Israel. I don't see how, the state is obviously important for many reasons, but when you think of it in messianic terms, as Rav Kook did, and then certainly his followers, I think it becomes very difficult in coming years for modern Orthodox Jews to really accept the very real changes that are going to take place in the state of Israel. Israel is going to become much more like a Western society in which Judaism is going to become less significant. How long can the state of Israel tell people that they have to go to Cyprus to get married? I mean, you have hundreds of thousands of Russians who want to get married, and halakhically they can't. And this idea that the rabbinate runs marriages has been very important. It's basic to the religious Zionist ideology. In other words, I don't think that Rav Kook's ideology, if we see where it's going, it's not the state that Rav Kook envisioned.
Mark,
Jonathan says he hopes so. I agree with you, because one thing is sure certain. In America, non-religious Jews, there's plenty of them, but they respect the orthodoxy, basically. They respect religion. You don't have people who are anti-religion. In Israel, the non-religious are anti-religious. And the reason they're anti-religious, we don't have this outside of Israel, people who are anti-religious, really, is because either they can be conservative or reform, but anti-religious. In Israel, the religious parties tried to force religion down their throat. And it has been totally unproductive, so we can start afresh. We're much better to get people, make them religious by bringing it to them, not forcing them to do things. They're saying they can't drive on Shabbos, and that doesn't work in the modern world. But that's a problem for the Kookian ideology, because the state itself is supposed to be Kodesh. The state is supposed to be holy. The army is supposed to be holy. And when the state then becomes secular, you're destroying a major stool, a major base of the whole Rav Kook ideology.
Mark, are you?
Yeah.
Can I make a comment?
And then I'll come to questions.
That,
yeah.
Are you saying that Reishis Smichas Gulasenu? I hear your point, but are you saying that it's less than it was in 1948? In other words, are you saying that perhaps you said at the beginning of the state, and now it's less of a chance to say it, or are you saying that from 1948 until today, it's the same that it's never been said?
I think in 1948, very few people could have said it shouldn't be said, because everyone was so hopeful. Rav Soloveitchik was one of the few who said that it never should have been said. But I'm saying now, in retrospect, I can show you a pamphlet, a letter signed by all these right-wing Aguda Gedolim, in which they basically declare that it's the beginning of the redemption sort of thing. It's very different now when you see how the state has... They thought mezuzahs would go up on every door. So that, I'm saying, looking at it now. Now, a few questions. Joey says there's plenty of anti-religious Jews in America. They're not anti-religious. Some of them might be anti-Orthodox, but I wouldn't say they're anti-religious. They're Reformed. Reformed Jews are religious. They're not halachic. And so I don't think there's anti. I don't think people in America are basically anti-religious. We don't have everyone basically gets married by a rabbi, except if you're complete secularists. And in terms of the battles over Erevin, you have to understand why they have these battles over Erevin. They don't want Orthodox Jews moving in, but it's not that they hate Orthodox Jews per se. If you look at certain towns, look at Teaneck, look at Englewood. The fact is, for good or bad, when Orthodox Jews move in, it basically means the end of the public school system, because the Orthodox Jews don't send their kids to public school. There becomes a tipping point, either 40 or 50%, when, let's say, in these towns, the whites, the Jews are no longer in the school systems, they become majority-minority, and then everyone leaves, and you end up with an all-black school system. So it creates real issues. These non-religious Jews want to send their kids to public school, and the public schools become non-inhabitable for their kids. So when they're fighting the Arab in places like Tenafly, it's not just that they don't like Orthodox Jews because they just don't like them. They really are concerned about property values. Now, that doesn't mean they have the right to do that legally, and that's why we fight it. But understand that they are really concerned about property values here, and it's undeniable that the school systems will suffer when Orthodox Jews come in. Orthodox Jews are running Lakewood now. If you want to know what's going on in Lakewood now, well, the Orthodox Jews are being favored. There's all sorts of problems. Orthodox Jews run Mount Kiryas Yoel, and there's all sorts of scandals going on up there. So there are reasons. I wouldn't say it's just because they don't like religion. A few more questions before we go on. Let me go. Go in order. Job asks, how basic is it to religious Zionist ideology that is almost deifying the state? It depends which religious Zionist ideology. It's an excellent question for Rabbi Soloveitchik. For the old Mizrahi ideology, pre-1967, it wasn't basic at all. But especially in 1967, religious Zionist ideology has become dominated by it, and in America it's certainly dominated by it. Religious Zionist ideology trumps everything else now. If you're in places like Teaneck or the Five Towns, Dove Hyken took out a big full-page ad in the Forward this week, you know, blasting Olmert. What gives him the right to do that? He lives in New York. He doesn't live in Israel because he believes he's a religious Zionist. So it depends what model of religious Zionism you have. What's the model now, and it's the Hezder model also, is not Rabbi Soloveitchik's model. Rav Lichtenstein has written about this different model, Rav Amital as well, but it has not been the dominant model, whether it now becomes one, which is a more realistic, realpolitik model. I think the difference might be in that the Rav Soloveitchik model, Yom HaAtzmaut, you'll do what the secular Israelis do, and by the way, many Israelis do it today, I hear, religious, you have a barbecue, whereas the other ideology is you're in shul all day, you're doing Tehillim, you have a special davening service. You know, it depends how invested do you become in what, at the end of the day, is a secular state. Does it have inherent validity, or is it valid, or is it value, inherent value, or is it valuable only to the extent that it allows Jews to lead a Jewish life, etc., etc.? Rav Soloveitchik thought the former, not the latter. Now, Rav Kook meant it as a, he didn't mean it as a hopeful outcome. Rav Kook thought that the wheels were now in place, that everything was moving forward, and that there was no turning back. History is inexorably written that we are going forward, and the non-religious would see the error of their ways, and his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, wrote even more explicitly about this. See, Rav Kook, he's writing before the state, so you can read him in more than one way, but I do believe, I mean, he does have universalist elements. I'll read some of it in a little while, but the particularist elements are very strong, and I don't think it's any accident that the followers of Rav Kook have 99% really come down in favor of this really strong, or 90%, let's say, a very strong religious Zionism. And I mean, Rav Kook wrote about the secularists as being holy, doing holy work. That translates into the state as being holy. That translates into, you know, a secular entity being holy. Yishai Leibovich thought this was a form of Avodah Zarah. But it's really not completely Rav Kook. Rav Kook just sets the kernel there. He writes about it, but it then gets developed by his followers. But everything's there, I believe. I don't think they're distorting him at all. Dove says the monopoly over marriages. It is basic, monopoly over marriages, because basic to religious ideology was that the state, as I said, is a function of Judaism. It's non-religious, so we certainly, we've made Shabbos the public sphere, and that's very nice. On the other hand, we've made Shabbos something terrible in the non-religious side, something we forced down their throat. Well, so I don't know if we've gained more than we've lost here. In other words, we haven't given them Shabbos as something nice. We've given them something that basically we forced them to do something they don't want to do. So it depends what you consider more valuable. The bracha for the Medina. Okay, so let's go on. That's one point. Now, there's great political also consequences to regarding the state as part of this redemptive process, and that we saw it last summer. Many opponents of territorial compromise are opposed because of security. Fine, you take an Ariel Sharon. You know, they were opposed, at least, for security reasons. And that's fine, I guess. But for many others, the concern is not that. The concern is faith, not security. According to them, anyone who is even willing to discuss giving up land shows a lack of emunah. If you look back last summer about the with the disengagement, it's true, you had people speaking about the security considerations, but if you look at the Merkaz crowds and the Rav Kook crowds, they weren't talking about that. None of them could actually ever explain, well, what's the long-term solution here? I mean, are you going to rule over millions of Arabs? For them, the answer is always, you have emunah. You have Hashem gave us this land. They are not in history. They are not in the present. They're in some sort of meta-history because they are already in part of the redemptive process. And the only way we can be worthy of achieving this redemption is by not faltering. By even thinking of giving up land, of having discussions, it shows that we don't have emunah. And that's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. We're not going to be led through. But it's striking if you look at all the religious Zionist writers who never really answered the question, well, what is the long-term prospects here? Because it's not an issue for them. Rav Soloveitchik thought that this was very dangerous. And this is really, if you have this mystical view, which goes back, I think, to Rav Kook, certainly to his son, you know, these are not issues. But if you live in the real world, realpolitik, then there is no mysticism. Then you have to deal with the real world. And I think that's part of the problem, that with Rav Kook's ideology, that leads to a dreamy mysticism, which is very good in the abstract, but in the real world, I don't think it's any accident that all the opponents of territorial compromise, Begin, Sharon, Netanyahu, when they come into power, they start talking compromise, because in the real world, that's the real world. So the Rav Kook ideology is an otherworldly vision. So I think for those two reasons, it's very problematic. And again, if you want to speak security, I'm not talking about that. I'm saying, no, to say that you're not going to do things for religious reasons, for mystical reasons, for metaphysical reasons. If you read the debate between Rav Avram Shapiro and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein about the withdrawal from Gaza, you get a good sense that Rav Avram Shapiro is not interested in any of these issues. You know, this is halacha, the Torah says it, we are given this land, and in a sense, I'm not going to say he's not sophisticated, he happens to be very sophisticated, but he's very simple-minded in this. This is just like Shabbos, you know, God's given us a Shabbos, he's given us the land. And Rav Lichtenstein is trying to talk about different values, and you have to weigh values, and they're talking a different language.
How would you put Rav Herschel Schechter? I'm just curious where he fits into this.
I don't know. I mean, he had a very strange idea that, yes, you can make these decisions, but only the religious. He said something no one in history has ever said, that only the Orthodox can make these decisions, no one else, as if the non-religious don't have a say on their future. I mean, I don't know, Rav Schechter's, but he's never really, as far as I know, is not in Rav Kook's camp. He definitely is a right-winger, but I don't know if it's for these messianic type of reasons. And there's nothing wrong with being a right-winger. All I'm saying is I think Rav Kook's ideology suffers a bit in today because it's otherworldly. And it's, I don't know, I think the other ideology, the old Maftal ideology, or Soloveitchik's ideology, is that we're in this world. The halacha is about this world. That's what halacha is all about. It's not interested in otherworldly. And when you're speaking about messianic ideas, and, you know, we're given a land and all this, that's you're confusing mysticism, you're confusing philosophy, you're confusing religious feeling with the bread and butter of Jewish law. And that's not, I don't think, personally, that's been very helpful. From 1967, if you look back to 1967, 68, how could anyone not be a cookie in it? Redemption was coming before our eyes. On the other hand, in the year 2006, it becomes much more difficult, I believe. Okay. Let me read some of these other comments before we move on. I have to move up a little. Good question about if you get rid of, let's say, Jewish marriage and all these things, what would bind them together? The question is there, that's what I'm saying, is something we need to recognize, what will bind them together? I don't know if at the end of the day Israel is going to be able to be bound together in that way, the civil rules. What percentage, for example, of Israel today is not Jewish? They don't even tell you the number. Could be 30%. You have Arabs and the Russians. We don't know. The point is that it's moving in that direction. Inexorably, the state of Israel is moving to a secular existence in which Jewish themes will be there, but it won't be the way it is now. And the question is, how do we respond? You're going to have religious Zionists who are going to throw up their hands, as some already have, and basically become Haredi, even though they don't dress the part, saying that the state is no longer a benefit to religious Jewry. Many of them have already done this. The state is standing in opposition to religious Jewry, so therefore we now love the land of Israel, but the state is our enemy. We've already had followers of Rav Kook adopt that position. That's a bad position to adopt, I'm saying. And Rav Kook's ideology perhaps doesn't recognize such a position, but if you have a Rav Soloveitchik position, then you're not really troubled by that. The state of Israel will be more Jewish or less Jewish, and you'll deal with it the way it is. All I'm saying is it would be great if the state of Israel was 100% Jewish and 100% religious. And maybe you can get 100% religious. But it's not going to get that way the way it is now, and therefore we're going into a different era. It's not the same era. Rav Schechter has an article saying you can't give up any land. That could be because he holds halachically you can't give up any land. That's also a position, but that's not necessarily a mystical position. I don't know what his reasoning is. Rav Soloveitchik obviously was Rav Schechter. You got to give him credit. He's not a yes man. Rav Soloveitchik is his Rebbe, but unlike Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Schechter takes many positions at odds with his teacher in a variety of areas. One of these, if you look at Nefesh HaRav, which is supposed to be, you know, his understanding of Rav Soloveitchik, he has a whole chapter there about the land of Israel. And nothing about Rav Soloveitchik's position, expressed numerous times in front of thousands of people, that giving up land is fine, it depends what the government says. He doesn't mention that, which I think was a bit of intellectual dishonesty, because he should have put it in. But he's his own man, he disagrees with the Rav in many areas, but, you know, in a sense, that makes him a great Talmud, because the Rav, unlike Haredi Gedolim, the Rav never said he created clones. He took a lot of pride in the fact. Take a look at his greatest Talmidim. Look in the 70s. He has Talmidim like Michal Shurkin, Chaim Ilsen. He also has Talmidim like Saul Berman, David Hartman. He has centrist Talmidim. Rav Soloveitchik never wanted to clone anyone. He never wanted his philosophical ideas to be, he believed in them, but he never required people to accept them. So the fact that Rav Schechter has different views than the Rav speaks highly, not just of the Rav, but also of Rav Schechter. But, the Rav Lichtenstein has more of a faith in the state of Israel than the Rav did. But other than that, I would say Rav Lichtenstein is. Okay, some other questions. The prophetic vision of society. Okay, that's a good point. Jonathan Hirsch says, England regarding the Anglican Church. Don't get me wrong. It would be very sad, I think, if Israel became like that. But all I'm saying is that Israel is moving already in that direction, that they're going to have civil marriage, that you're going to have... just think of the numbers, like I said. We have 20% Arab, and what percent Russian? 10%, 15%, who aren't even totally Jewish. We don't know the numbers. We could be at 30% right now non-Jews in the land state of Israel, and the number grows and grows. So the point is that, you know, I'm going to Jerusalem on January 7th. I will not leave Jerusalem. I go there a week. I literally never leave. But I had to go to Tel Aviv the last time I was there, and you walk to Tel Aviv, what you might have is Jerusalem will always be Jewish. But today, you walk in Tel Aviv and Haifa, what can I say? I don't know. All my point is only that I don't think Rav Kook's ideology can survive this. Classic religious Zionism, Rav Soloveitchik can survive it, because classic religious Zionism, Mizrahi was ready to take Uganda. How can they take Uganda? Because religious Zionism is not only about the land. It's not only about setting up religious marriage. And it's about religious Jews controlling their own destiny in their own land, but not necessarily the land of Israel. We can still live in the land of Israel, even if you know, there's no rabbi saying you have to be married this way. Or Shav, you know, that's my only point. Yeah, Rabbi Kelvin? we might have to live that way, and it'll be a terrible thing, but religious Zionism will not die. I think Rav Kook's view, though, might die, and instead you might have people... There have been people who've said, if they give back land, let's say, to the Palestinians, if they could live there, they would live there. Why? Because they regard... It's still Eretz Yisrael. It's holy. So they would live in Hebron or any other... Because they'd be still in the midst of living in the land of Israel. From the classic religious Zionist perspective, that makes no sense at all. You're going to live under Arab rule because it's the land of Israel? That's not religious Zionism. Religious Zionism is not about living in the land of Israel. The Haredim want to live in the land of Israel, too. They can live under Arab rule and fulfill Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Religious Zionism is about living under Jewish rule. That is, the non-Jews don't control you. It's not about the land per se. The land is great, but if it's not the land, you could live in Uganda, but now we have the land, that's much better. But you're not going to live in the land under non-Jewish control. That just means you're fulfilling the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel, but you're not a Zionist. Zionists mean Jews make their own destiny. But many people obviously feel that the Orthodoxy can't stand. Let's move on. There's another problem with Rav Kook's approach, and that is that it's paternalistic. It doesn't take the other side seriously. It doesn't take the non-religious seriously. That is, the non-religious are staying their position. We're non-religious. We don't accept. We don't see how, why we have to eat certain foods to be regarded as a good Jew. And from Rav Kook's standpoint, we don't take seriously what they're saying. Today, I think we understand that if you want to have constructive dialogue with the other side, that you have to take what the other side says seriously. Listen to what they say, and then deal with it, respond to it. Whereas Rav Kook, they were saying, well, we don't really accept religion. No, no. His attitude was, well, you really do. You just don't know it, and at the end of days, you'll discover it, and that what you're doing is really helping religion. He didn't respect differences, Rav Kook. His whole point was that they don't realize what they're doing. We today respect differences, and I don't think that you can have a real relationship with someone if they don't think you understand them. If the non-religious think that we are involved with them is because we're really using them, because we think that they're really, without knowing it, are helping religion, we can't have a real relationship with them. We're asserting something of them that contradicts their essential identity. Their identity is that they're not religious. Rav Kook did not respect a different viewpoint because he didn't deny its reality. And I don't see how we can have dialogue with them. You know, the Hartman Institute understands this well. Hartman Institute knows that if you don't respect the authenticity of the other side and understand the other side as the other side understands itself, there can be no real dialogue. Rav Kook was not interested in dialogue. Rav Kook was interested in, as if he's standing on a mountain, explaining what the non-religious were doing and what the religious are doing and how the synthesis is coming. But we can't relate that way. We need to deal with these non-religious Jews. And I agree with what Alan says. Of course, politics does debase religion. It always has. So I think we therefore see a real historical evolution. The traditional view of the non-religious was one of complete rejection. Look at the early descriptions of the non-religious. Rav Kook argued for acceptance of the non-religious because they're the non-religious in Israel, because their actions were in some way, even if unknown to themselves, directed towards God. What I'm saying is that today we have to move beyond this, and we have to relate to the other, we have to love the other Jew in our postmodern era with an unconditional, non-paternalistic approach. The paternalism of Kook simply doesn't work, and it's not, is the Hartman Institute Orthodox? No, the Hartman Institute is post-denominational. I mean, it's run by Orthodox, and most of the faculty members, I believe, are Orthodox, but it's post-denominational in that it believes in Orthodox and non-Orthodox coming together. I've never been there, but the whole ideology is coming together and discussing differences and trying to bring religious values to bear on society. But it's not Orthodox per se. I mean, if you're Orthodox, you don't have non-Orthodox people speaking there. I mean, you don't have dialogue. You don't do that. So it's not Orthodox per se. Okay, now I want to now, in the time we have left, I did have some selections from Oroth, which I was going to read, but I'm not going to read them because we don't have time. I had some amazing sections. Let me just read one of them from Shmona Kvatzim. First, you see in this, Rav Kook's, he writes personally. These are his personal diaries. He writes, for example, I love everything. It's impossible for me to not love anything. I love all nations. You know, I mean, you see this universalism that comes out. he goes further. He writes about how the small elements, Diduk HaPratim HaHelchotiyim, that pilpul, the Talmud study in its details, really, sometimes you get involved in the small aspects, the pratim, you lose sight of the big picture. He wants to be involved in the big picture, but he says you can't separate, he says, from min hakamakom, from what everyone does, and therefore I'm a rabbi, I need to do this. So you see the tension here of Cook. He doesn't really want to involve himself all day with studying halakha, but he has to. This is a problem, by the way, you see in the Rambam, you see in many Rishonim, that Kaspi is most famous. Joseph Ibn Kaspi tells a story how he's a medieval philosopher, that a fleshic spoon fell into some milk, and he didn't know what to do, so he went to the rabbi. He told this whole story, and the rabbi told him, and then he says, and don't think that makes me worse, because I didn't know the halacha. I'm spending my time on big things, on philosophy. The rabbi's job is just he's the technician. If I want to know what to do with my spoon, I go to the rabbi. And really, the Hasidim picked up on this, and Ibn Ezra says the same thing, pretty much the Hasidim picked up on this Kaspi approach. In the Hasidic world, who is the king? It's not the Rav, the Dayan. It's the Rebbe. The Rebbe's involved in spirituality. If you want to know what the law is, you go to the Posek. Rav Kook is expressing his Hasidic ideas here, saying that he doesn't really want to be involved in the small and itty-gritty details. He wants to be involved in the big things. But it shows the tension. In another passage, he speaks about how he has to be involved in all things. And finally, this they wouldn't print till now. He says this is a direct translation. There are times when someone hates chachmat chitzoniot, hates secular studies. And why does he hate secular studies? Deep down, he really hates Torah. He really hates wisdom at all. He wants to be a hedonist. He doesn't want to be involved in intellectual matters. But he knows that he has to absorb his hatred for Torah because he's afraid he's going to be punished by Hashem. So, and he knows that it's a mitzvah to learn Torah, so he has to study Torah. That's why he does it. But he really doesn't like, he has no intellectualism. And therefore, he hates all intellectualism, but he can't show his hatred on Torah, so he throws it on things that are secular in his mind. He doesn't see any value on them. And by the way, I lived in a Haredi community for a few years, and I thought when I went there, I'd see real love, real intellectualism, love of Torah in all its aspects. Instead, I saw a lot of people who they could be very open about it. Why they learn Torah? They learn Torah because it's an obligation. And if there wasn't an obligation, a chiyuv, a mitzvah to learn Torah, then they would be playing basketball. And that's the totally wrong view of it. The Aglai Tal, the Sakhar Shavar, writes about it, how we're not supposed to learn Torah because it's a ritual. If we learn Dafyomi, we're obligated to learn Torah. The Sakhar Shavar, someone came to him, he was concerned that if he fulfilled the mitzvah of learning Torah because he enjoyed Torah. You know, he would learn Torah even if there wasn't an obligation. He loved learning it. And the Sakhar Shavar said, of course, that's the highest level. It's only the lowest people that need to learn because they have to. And I came across many people who learning Torah was like davening. It was a religious obligation. That's why they learned. And it's that's what Rav Kook is speaking about. These people who don't have this love for learning, and therefore, if you have a love for learning, you have a love for all learning. People who have a hatred for, let's say, learning science and other things, it really means, he's saying, that they have a hatred for learning, all learning. They're forced to study Torah, so they study Torah, but really, they're at such a low level, because the soul of a really, truly person who's connected to God wants to roam the expanses and discover everything. It's a very interesting insight.
Well, because Rav Kook, many different ideologies. First of all, Rav Kook did not live in modern Orthodox society. He lived as a holy, a polished person. He didn't go to secular universities. Hirsch believed in Auschwitz, separatism from the non-Orthodox. Hirsch was an anti-Zionist. So I'm saying is that you can't say, you know, some people would say, oh, Shapiro's talk saying they're modern Orthodox. Well, they oppose this and that. And Rav Kook spoke about certain things, you know, the problems of certain problems in Zionism, etc. All I'm saying is that they certain ideas that they have, any more than the Rambam is modern Orthodox, but certain ideas that these thinkers have are basic to the modern Orthodox ideology, which then, of course, have moved forward. I'm not saying that they would agree with everything, but these are architects of modern Orthodoxy because they set forth the ideology. Just like the Chasam Sofer is basic to today's Haredi views. Would he agree with all the things that they do today? The Chasam Sofer writes that there's no reason to eat Klal Kosher. And yet the Haredim today say that only kosher is God kosher. So but still, the Chasam Sofer is basic to the ideology, although then, of course,
any living organism, any religious philosophy, has to move forward and develop itself. That's all I'm saying. Any other comments, questions, or criticisms?
Okay, I want to thank you on behalf of everybody. We look forward, we hope, to continuation in 2007. And I'm hoping we're going to send out a survey. We do want to get, you know, feedback and ideas. Obviously, this has been, a good experiment, and we want to grow it and see how we can improve it and expand it, really.
Okay. If there's any other questions or comments before we go, you can talk if you want. No one has that. Okay, the last class, we went on lots of comments, lots of questions. I thought that I'm going to get people saying that I'm a defeatist. You know, this is not religious Zionism. I'm a little surprised here. And then I would explain that this is Soloveitchik's religious Zionism.
On the contrary, I think you provided a perspective that kind of spans the decades and really kind of puts things in their place. And it's some good food for thought.
Well, thank you. Where was
Hillel?
Hillel.
Hello, Betson. He was here. He left. We're in overtime now, so people leave, you know?
Okay, as I said last class, Hillel Bezdin is not here. His father, Abraham Bezdin, you might have seen the book, The Man of Faith in the Modern World, the first student of the Rav to put the Rav's ideas into print. Now, as I said, everyone's doing it. They're coming out with a new book every year. But before it was fashionable, he was the only one in English. He put out two volumes, so there's a big zechus there. And look, if we ever discuss Soloveitchik, we discuss also the issue, which also politically incorrect, is there too much Soloveitchik? Are we becoming like the Hirschians, in which everything was Hirsch, now it seems the modern orthodoxy, everything is Soloveitchik, and the Rav wasn't into this sort of hero worship, so it's a good, something that needs to be discussed. Scott has a comment.
I'm wondering with some of these speakers, if in a certain sense you're taking them too seriously, and that maybe they meant much of what they said as remedies for their time, and were reading into it so deeply as universal philosophies, when really they were just trying to be practical. And maybe if they're around today, maybe Rav Hirsch wouldn't talk about Osterich and et cetera.
It's a good point. In that little contrast I told you about the second class by this former Washington Heights person who attacks the Washington Heights community, he makes that exact point. I don't know if anyone ordered it from him. He says that one thing we can all agree with, that Tzarim Derech Eretz is eternal, because Hirsch says so. And you, Washington Heights community, have jettisoned Tzarim Derech Eretz. But we can also agree that Austrit is only temporary. It only applies when there are non-religious who we feel are dangerous to us. And therefore, today, we certainly have the right to revisit it, whether today's non-religious are dangerous to us. And yet you, Washington Heights, have made Austrit eternal and thrown Tzarim Derech Eretz apart. It is possible. I will say that Isaac Breuer, his grandson, when he went to Israel, pretty much abandoned the traditional Austrit. There were thinkers who argued that Austrit was not eternal. It was temporary. But there have been thinkers who argued that Tzarim Derech Eretz isn't eternal. The difference is Hirsch is clear Tzarim Derech Eretz is eternal. He's not clear about Austrit. Although I would say that if you are a Hirschian, you still need Austrit. Austrit is not eternal, perhaps, if you're dealing with non-religious Jews, maybe in Israel, for example, who have no connection to religion. But I think if you're a real Hirschian, Austrit is just as much applicable today as it was in Frankfurt. You're dealing with conservative rabbinate, reform rabbinate. I don't see how you can really be a Hirschian and not believe in Austrit. That's why I think we have to be honest and say that if we don't want to have this viewpoint, we are not complete Hirschians. And I don't think the Hirschians are wrong when they say we are Hirschians, we are believe in Austrit. So it is practical, but I think from a Hirschian standpoint, it continues.
Mark, what you said though, it does not apply to to any historical thinker in any field. I mean, you can study the ideas, but you can ultimately never know what they would have said after they died.
Of course, and that's why every great thinker. You don't need many great thinkers. Soloveitchik has only been dead 10 years, 12 years. And as soon as he passed away, you had different people giving, you had Rabbi Braunschweig, you had Saul Berman, you had everyone giving different positions. Any great thinker is going to have different views. People are going to read him differently. We said that's what makes Rav Kook so great. Everyone has that, so that's to be expected. That's what we historians argue about, though. But I'm saying that that doesn't mean that every position is okay. You can't say, for example, that Rav Kook would be an anti-Zionist. You can't say that Satmar Rebbe, if he was around today, he'd see how his ideology failed, therefore he'd be a Zionist. I mean, people will say things like that, but you know, it doesn't necessarily make sense by most people's eyes. So I don't think the Hirschians today are distorting Hirsch by adopting Auschwitz. That's my only point. I still think that they are authentic Hirschians. Certainly the ones who've gotten rid of Torim Derech Eretz, they are not authentic Hirschians.
All right, we'll let everybody go.
Okay, it was a lot of fun, and as is in previous weeks, I'm sure some of you will email me, and I can, if you want to follow up, but it was a lot of fun, and everyone have a Freilich Hanukkah, and hopefully we'll see each other again.
Yashar Koach. Thanks a lot. Good night, everybody.